Welcome back to the Stanford Psychology Podcast, where leading psychologists share their most recent work. This week, I was excited to be chatting with Susan Fisk, Eugene Higgins Professor of Psychology and Professor of Public Affairs at Princeton University. Susan is one of the world's leading scholars studying social cognition, having written more than 400 articles and chapters, as well as several books, including Envy Up, Scorn Down, and The Human Brand. She has won more awards than could possibly be listed, including a Guggenheim Fellowship and the APA Distinguished Scientific Contributions Award. Susan's biography is currently being highlighted in the 40 Women in Science, Engineering, and Medicine exhibit at the National Academy of Sciences, to which she was elected in 2013. In this episode, we chat about Susan's latest work on how diverse environments paradoxically make us see different ethnic groups as more, not less similar. In the second half of the chat, Susan reveals why she brings exotic chocolate to lab meetings and how to find a research idea worth pursuing. She talks about her complicated journey into academia and how she developed her influential stereotype content model. She discusses the importance of female role models and the obstacles women face in academia. As if that is not exciting enough, she even gives dating advice. Hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Today, I am beyond excited to be talking with none other than Susan Fisk for the Stanford Psychology Podcast. Before we delve into your exciting new research, let me just thank you for taking the time and joining us.
My pleasure.
I want to start our conversation by talking about a paper you have sent me called As Diversity Increases, People Paradoxically Perceive Social Groups as More Similar. Before we unpack what that means, I want to start our conversation the way you start the paper, which is with a beautiful quote from Viet Thanh Nguyen, which goes as follows. To love, to laugh, to live, to work, to fail, to despair, to parent, to cry, to die, to mourn, to hope. These attributes exist whether we are Vietnamese or Mexican or American or any other form of classification. We share much more in common with one another than we have indifference. I think that is a beautiful quote to start us off. I would like to ask you about the general motivation to write this paper, the background of immigration and globalization that motivated you to write this paper.
Well, I think there is a worldwide discomfort with newness right now, that because of globalization and increase in immigration all over the world, people are encountering more and more different people from different groups than they're used to and faster. So the numbers are increasing and the speed is increasing and people don't have time to get used to each other. You know, maybe one group at a time used to come to the United States or maybe two at once, but predominantly. And so it seemed to me that we needed to account for how people cope with all this diversity. It's a big challenge for the little human mind to make sense of the newcomers. And, you know, most people are suspicious a little bit of people who are different from them, who they think are different from them. And that's understandable. You know, I have some sympathy for people's nervousness about people who are different. So this is all in the context of my having grown up in a fairly stable, racially integrated neighborhood. But the point was, it wasn't changing. And so it was very comforting, and the adults thought it was a good idea.
Now, I study cynicism, which are very grim views of human nature. And one cynical take on this could be, well, we are just tribalistic creatures. One thing that we have in common, ironically, is that we like the people who are like us. We dislike people who we put in some outgroup. It's an us versus them competition. We will always have conflict when we meet someone from the outgroup. This is just who we are. But of course, psychologists might say it's more complicated than this. And there's also something called contact theory, that maybe not always when we meet people different from us, there's conflict. And I wonder if you could just speak a little bit to the background of why you would think contact with outgroup members can lead to conflict versus contact and cooperation.
So I think there are levels of contact. And I think actually the paper that we're talking about at the moment, it's a little agnostic about what kind of contact people are having. My guess is that it's not necessarily, we can go into this later, but it's not very deep contact. I think it just is the presence of other people. So there's one level of contact, which is you see people in public places. You see them on the subway every day. They're in the cafe. And maybe at first this makes you uncomfortable, and then nothing bad happens. Nothing bad happens on Monday, and nothing bad happens on Tuesday and Wednesday. And unless somebody foments discomfort and anger and resentment at difference, you know, if this just keeps going on day after day, even if they wear funny clothes, you know, and they continue to speak their funny language, if nothing bad happens, then at some point you can't keep being alert about them and vigilant and suspicious because, you know, they're not a problem. And most human beings who are not in danger of their lives at every moment do habituate to things. So I think that's one level of contact that we haven't studied enough. We've studied a little bit. And I think that's what's going on in this paper. But I think superficial contact can have an effect like this. You just get used to people, unless there's a demagogue in charge of your country.
So there are different hypotheses one might have.
Yeah.
What happens when people get exposed on the superficial level to people who are different from them? And you outline two different hypotheses.
In fact, the authors had different hypotheses.
So it was an adversarial collaboration within the paper.
Well, in effect, we didn't realize we had different hypotheses till we started to talk about it. But Miguel Ramos, who was, this is relevant, you know, his ethnicity is Portuguese, but he was trained in the UK, and then he came to the US for a postdoc. So, you know, he was cheerful about immigration. And the other co-author, Shuya Bai, also is a multiple times immigrant, Korean in China, Chinese in Japan, and then some mix of East Asian in the US. And so both of them had experience with being on the receiving end of this. Both of them were inclined to be optimistic. And I said, if somebody has never encountered somebody who's different from them, how can they have any stereotypes about them? How can they have any point of view about what these groups are like? It's only when you're exposed to them that you develop differentiated stereotypes. And they said, no. The more you see people, the more they seem the same. And I said, nah, that can't happen. You have to have really teamwork and the authority sanctions and all these other things. So we went into it saying it wasn't going to happen.
And the optimists won.
They did. And what amazed me was that we kept throwing big data sets at the problem, and they kept finding the same thing. So, I mean, if you live in New York and you're exposed to a lot of different immigrants, at some point you say, I can't tell you what a Mexican is like. I've met a lot of different Mexicans, and they're not the same. And besides, they're all New Yorkers, you know. And Hawaii is the same way, you know. We're all Hawaiian. Aloha. The other interesting thing about the results in this study, where you have the stereotype content model map in a two-dimensional space, is that the distinctions among different groups of people not only get smaller, like a melting pot, but they move up toward the more positive part of the space. So not only are these people not that different from each other, they're more like us. And, you know, this is one of those findings that I was really happy to see. And I was happy to see it replicate at the level of nations, at the level of states, at the level of people going from a high school to college that's more diverse or the same. Any individual people judging the diversity of their community, whatever level of analysis we were operating on, it came out each time. And there's a footnote to this, which is that Miguel Ramos also did a paper with my husband, Doug Massey, at the same time. They found, looking all over the world, it takes about 6 or 7 years, maybe 8. So there's even a time estimate on how long this takes, assuming nothing bad happens. And I think that's an important caveat, because people can be incited to kill each other off, you know, under those circumstances. But if nothing bad happens and there are no famines or demagogues or civil wars, then, you know, people get used to each other.
That's a hopeful message. Just to clarify how we measure stereotype dispersion, you were just alluding to this has to do with the stereotype content model.
Yes. So we have a theory that's now 20 years old, so I won't talk about it in detail because you want today's, but I have to talk about it because it's very cool. So our theory is, in a few sentences, the first thing you need to know about a new group coming to your country or a new person coming into your lab is, what are their intentions? Do they intend to exploit and compete and try to kill you off, or are they going to cooperate and grow the pie? That's really important to know. And you can understand that people would have evolved an attention to other people's intention. And then you need to know if they can act on their intention, because if they're, you know, an angry bunny rabbit in Monty Python, except that's an exception, but, you know, if they're an angry, incapable person, it doesn't really matter as much as if they're highly competent. On the other hand, if they have good intentions and they're highly competent, then they're more likely to advance your shared interests. So warmth by competence is very simple. A lot of people have thought of similar things over the years. That's reassuring to me. You can map the groups in the space of warmth by competence. I can't do this on a podcast, but people should look up one of the papers and just look at the map, because you look at the map and you say, oh, I get it. I see who's, you know, who are the sort of cold, rich people. I see who are the despised outgroup. I see who's pitiful. And I see who is the national, you know, exemplar. Anyway, so in Vermont, where I am now, this model would say, you have to understand, Vermont is 97% white. But apparently, people have very distinct stereotypes about what Mexicans are like. They've never met a Mexican, but they do, you know, and they can be authoritative about that and see the spread of all these groups from each other. But not so in New York and Hawaii. So that's the dispersion I'm talking about. Are the groups spread out across this space or not? And I have to praise Bai and Miguel, because they thought up this dispersion measure, and they thought up using the Herfindahl index of difference among groups, different numbers of groups.
And you find this effect not only in the US, but you have looked globally across countries and you find the same thing, right? So there are some countries that are relatively high in diversity and then low in diversion, where groups are seen as somewhat more similar, even though there's many diverse groups to perceive, such as Peru, Canada, South Africa. And then there's countries that are not as diverse and they have more distinct stereotypes about outgroups, such as Denmark and Greece, which makes it even more powerful, right? This is not just a US-specific finding.
Yeah, exactly.
And as you have alluded to, even more powerful, it is one thing to establish, okay, in more diverse communities, people perceive their outgroups to be more similar. It's another to establish, well, similar in what ways, right? Maybe they are seen as similarly cold and incompetent, and that would not be a good finding, but you find the opposite.
You know, there is a positivity bias in person perception, but that's mostly been studied within in-groups. But, you know, I'm basically a slightly optimistic person, you know, and when you look at individual person perception, you have to add a positivity constant to the equation as a starter. You know, I'm meeting you for the first time and my basic assumption is slightly positive. You know, my basic assumption is not, oh, he's going to be out to get me and make me look stupid, you know. I mean, it's more adaptive to be slightly positive, because then you keep your eyes open, but you do approach people who might have something to offer.
I personally could not agree more, but I also think there are people like this, of course, who by default distrust people and assume the worst in others. And so I wonder about individual differences where maybe exposure to diversity might backfire.
Yeah, well, there are individual differences. People who like things to be the same all the time and predictable, and they find it overstimulating to deal with difference, and who don't like to try new things. They're not real fond of diversity, and they tend to be more conservative because they don't like change. But if you think about the species or even the tribe that you live in, you want some members of the tribe to try new stuff. And you want your members of the tribe to intermarry with other members of other tribes, because if they don't, you're going to have terrible genetic problems. So, you know, some people say, well, it's good to use the disposable young people to try the new stuff, because if they haven't reproduced yet and they get killed, well, so what, you know. But But I do think it's interesting that teenagers, you know, try a lot of things.
Before we start to zoom out from this specific paper, one more question, which is the final study you have. Because so far we have correlational data, we have cross-sectional evidence, but you also have a study on a longitudinal sample of students as they move from high school to college.
When I met my husband, he had this data set. And I said, I fell in love with him for his data. He had 1,000 white students, 1,000 Asians, 1,000 Latinos, and 1,000 black students at 28 selective colleges and universities. And they interviewed these kids the fall of their freshman year and then every single year until they graduated. And so the fall of their freshman year, they retroactively rated their life in high school. And then you could follow them and see various measures that they took. So it's a great series of studies. Anyway, so the part of it that we took out was each respondent's estimate of how diverse their high school was. And then averaged over time how diverse their college experience was. And so it's, in a way, a natural experiment, I have to put that in air quotes because, you know, people are also choosing the school they go to. But before they went, there was no difference between the groups that end up in more diverse and less diverse colleges. So there were no pre-existing obvious differences. So, yes, we have change over time. So I really have to credit, you know, Miguel Ramos and Bai, because they just had the chutzpah. You know, they were going to just try this, tackle these data sets, teach themselves how to analyze them. And they did, and they were right. So
it really saddens me to contrast this reality with how our news operate, where we oftentimes hear news such as, you know, the Chinese retaliate and it's, you know, against some tech policy. And it's almost like the whole population of people living in China coming together and discussing foreign policy. When, of course, once you travel there, you realize these people have similar worries to us. They worry about what their boss said at work, what their spouse said, if they can feed their family, if they are on time for a date, whatever it is, right? We're much more similar. These are not very different groups of people living in different countries.
Well, I will say that when we do the stereotype content model applied around the world, and we do this for free because it's open access, in effect. So people contacted us and said, oh, I want to see what the map is of my country. And I said, oh, it's easy. It's cheap. And it turns out you don't need a representative sample because everybody knows what the stereotypes are. So you don't even have to spend money on a representative sample. So people ask, you know, 4 questions about the groups that a preliminary bunch of people have named as being the relevant groups in their society. And they spread out across the space and you say, oh, okay, I get it. It turns out that people, when they're talking about another country, and we've done this for the United States because we care about it, it's our country. You know, what do you think of different countries in the world? Well, Americans are seen as bullies, basically. Yeah. Competent, forceful, determined, you know, but not real nice. But the American government is differentiated from the American people. American people are liked better. I mean, it's not necessarily a whole quadrant away, but it's different. And we also differentiate between other people, you know, other groups of people in their government. So, you know, there's some hope.
Speaking about the role of media, there's a lot of discussion now about how the media can portray diversity. And if done effectively, maybe we can find some effects of stereotype dispersion lowered if diversity is portrayed correctly. But of course, there is a lot of ways to portray diversity wrong. What are your thoughts on the media landscape playing a role in this?
First of all, I think you have to have diversity in the media. It's better now than it was when I was growing up, but it's not representative of the reality of our culture. I guess I would say 2 things. I mean, one is the representation of different kinds of people. When my daughter was growing up, I made sure to have children's books where there were a variety of people in the book. And it was especially nice when there was no comment about the variety, where just, you know, somebody had 2 dads And that was just how it was, you know. Then there was another story where somebody's dad was a giant. Well, that one they had to acknowledge it. But anyway, so you can just expose people to diversity. And that's sort of like what I've been talking about with regard to our diversity and dispersion people. But then you can also tell different stories about the same group. And it makes people come to different conclusions. So if you'll indulge me for a second, you can talk about immigrants as being the dregs of their society and being people who didn't fit in and failed where they were, so they're trying somewhere else. And they're coming to, you know, steal from us, compete with us. Or you can say, we make it really hard to immigrate. And it is hard to immigrate. You have to leave your family and your language and your culture and go someplace new where you don't know anybody and you'd sound stupid when you talk. And it's really hard. And, you know, the U.S. resists immigration to jump through a lot of hoops to get here. So you have to be a very determined, resourceful person to get here. And then once you get here, you don't want to get in trouble. You want to, you know, grow the economy because you want to be successful and send money home to your family or whatever. And so that selects for very hardworking, committed people who don't want to get in trouble. You know, so depending on which story you tell about immigration, you end up with different inferences about what kind of people these are. So I'm a believer somewhat in stories. And I think the stories have, well, it's what we're working on now.
Do you want to expand a little bit on what you're working on now? Is this a new direction that you are investigating?
Yeah, sure. So I have a third year. She's going into her third year, graduate student from Ireland. Her parents were immigrants to Ireland, and now she's, in effect, an immigrant to the U.S. I've never asked her why she's interested in stories, but I'm a English major manqué. So, I tried taking English literature courses because I love really good literary fiction. But the trouble was they were all about the critics. They weren't about the story. And I was interested in the people and the stories, you know, so it was very unsatisfying. So I quit English Lit and eventually made my way to psychology. Anyway, so my student, Naomi Vida, and I decided to look at the power of stories. And we have a couple other collaborators, Aline Komen, who's a professor, Jamie Walsh, who just finished his PhD at Oxford. Anyway, all of us are interested in stories. And stories have particular characteristics that make them influential. For example, they take you out of yourself and out of your present circumstances, so you don't counter-argue as much because you're suspending everything else in disbelief. You get involved with the protagonist. You have suspense because you want things to get resolved. Protagonist has a goal that's thwarted in some way, usually. Anyway, so they have all these characteristics that make you get deeply involved. So they seem like a good way to persuade people that immigrants, for example, are more like us than different. We're manipulating all the main features of stories. All four of us did this great big lit review of what makes a story a story from a psychological point of view. We're manipulating each of these and seeing whether you get more change on images of immigrants. Similar things have been done before, but we're doing it differently, and then we're taking it into conversation. So this is if it all works out. There may be, my experience is that when somebody comes in planning to study something in particular with me, we spend the whole 5 years answering preliminary questions, then they go off and do what we both wanted to do after they leave. But sometimes we get started on that.
Well, this relates to a question I wanted to ask you. How do you run your lab?
Well, I view it as a sort of a continuing conversation over 5 years. And the beginning of the conversation is, what are you interested in? What lights you up? What lights me up? Is it the same? And usually you don't interview people unless you think you have something in common. And just, is it fun to talk together? And do you sort of build on each other's ideas, or do you argue in a constructive way? Both of those are fun. Also, are both people open to being influenced by the other? So somebody comes to me for interested in graduate school. And they say, I want to study X, and I want to do it in this following design and these measures. I say, fine, but, you know, I'd like to have a conversation about it. And if they're not open to my saying, well, how about if you did it this way, or how about if you did it that way, or what if your hypothesis is backwards? If they're not interested in playing with the ideas, then what's the point? And that's fine, they can do that, but it's not what I want to do. At the beginning, we have more mutual influence, I would say. And then as their training goes on, they have more say over what we do. But at the beginning, I like to be deeply involved. And then it's an individualized experience. So I discover, you know, this person is more developed in this way, like experimental design, and less developed in something else, like making it intuitive and real for the subjects. Or somebody else is all about making it intuitive and real, but not about experimental design or measurement. You know, so I've had both kinds of students. I mean, the exciting thing about graduate school is that you learn what you can do when you're working with all your cylinders at once. And there will be some things that no matter how hard you work, you're just not very good at them. And you can still do it, but you have to know that you're doing it at some cost. You know, you just decide, is this the hill I'm going to die on? You know, trying to learn this new technique. And over time, you learn what you're good at. So for me, you know, I learned that I'm better at hunches about how people interact with each other than I am about items in free recall. You know, I'm just not a very good cognitive psychologist. But, you know, I like thinking about people more than I like thinking about memory for its own sake. Yeah, so, you know, in part you want to go with your strengths, but also you want to learn things, right? Why would you go to graduate school if you knew everything? So that's kind of how it is. And I meet regularly with all my students. Everybody gets half an hour a week, plus the lab meeting. And so that makes us both accountable. And, you know, if people need to cancel a meeting, they cancel a meeting, it's fine. But the other thing is the lab meeting is very important. So we have people from juniors, certainly seniors, all the way up through visitors from other countries. And everybody has to present their ideas at the beginning. What are you going to do? How are you going to test it? And other people give them feedback. And so the seniors who are doing senior theses, everybody at Princeton does a senior thesis with a faculty member. They see that, you know, criticism's okay. And people are giving you alternatives, and that doesn't make you stupid or a bad person. You know, everybody's going to be on the hot seat. And you can improve your work, and you can improve your work in the family. So, you know, when we don't have COVID and I'm on campus, you know, I bring a different kind of exotic chocolate every week. And I try to find, you know, really strange ones in airports. Especially the more exotic the airport, the better. I guess I would say, what was the strangest one? I don't know, maybe chocolate-covered dates from the Middle East. Anyway, so, you know, we try to create a sort of relaxed atmosphere. But people perform for each other because they want to do the best they can, you know, because the other people are smart. So, I hope people feel launched by the time they get done because they've taken more and more responsibility for their own work. But at the beginning, when they're too inexperienced to take a lot of responsibility for it, then we're more sort of deeply involved.
I am curious about this process of launching specifically. How does one find the one idea that will get you through grad school, through postdoc?
Oh, that's the wrong approach. So there are lots of things that you could do that would be wonderful. This is sort of like how you find a mate. There are lots of people in the world of whatever sex you are interested in, maybe both, who could be a great partner for you. And so it's not like there's only one you can find. So I think of it as being like a template. You're like half a thing, and the other half will fit you. And there are multiple things that could fit you. And so a lot of it is learning by experiencing, learning by doing. You know, so you work on a couple projects during grad school. You know, you like one of them better than the other, or one of them just keeps blowing up in your face and never working. You know, maybe there's a message there. Maybe you just don't have good hands with that kind of project. And, you know, much as you might want to do it and admire it when other people do it, you know, don't keep hitting your head against the wall. It's like asking the same potential partner out several times and the person keeps saying no. At some point you say, okay, I get it. Fine. You're a loss. I think waiting for lightning to strike is a big mistake. One clue as to what might be interesting for you would be, do you keep having the same ideas in different forms over and over again? Yeah, in my case, I was going to say, I gave a talk at Stanford about an idea I had in 1977, which was the idea that schema-triggered affect. And so the idea was that when you categorize somebody and they fit a schema, you know, this person reminds me of an old flame. There are emotions that are triggered by that. Susan Anderson did a better job of studying it. But, you know, I did a few studies and I talked about it at Stanford early in my career. And probably not a good idea to talk about things that were in progress and not fully worked out. But I'm still convinced that the basic idea is right, that, you know, categorization can lead to emotion pretty automatically. I think when you have an idea that grabs you every time, then you should study it because there's something going on that makes it matter to you. So when you're reading things for classes or listening to lectures, and this, if you're relaxed enough, there's a still little voice in the back of your head that goes, why are they doing it that way? That's not how I would do it. They don't have the concept at all. Why are they such idiots about it? Or, you know, they did this study this way and the other study the other way. And that's not the same concept. So if you just make little notes about that, then if you ever look back at all your notes, you say, why do I keep thinking about affect and cognition? You know, what's the matter with me? Well, nothing's the matter. It's just you have ideas about it that you feel are not being expressed in the world. Then maybe you're the person to pursue that topic. That's a little broad, but you know, you get the idea. So I think you just try different stuff. Expose yourself to a lot of different kinds of thinking. You know, do pilot studies. And when you get an effect, especially if it's interesting and you get it more than once, stay with it. Play with it. Take it out for a walk. Teach it tricks. Make it come and go. And then you understand your phenomenon.
It is one thing to know what to research. It is another entirely to know, should I even do research? Is this going to be my professional career? And I have this strange bias where I know it was a complicated journey for me and many people I know. But then I look at professors and I have this perception that they knew it all along, right? They came into the world and they knew they wanted to do research. But then I talk to professors and oftentimes it's more complicated. When did you first know that you wanted to do research?
Looked at from the outside, it was overdetermined. Looked at from the inside, it was a big agony and a puzzle and a journey. So looked at from the outside, my father was a famous psychologist. So he wrote co-wrote the most cited paper in Psych Bulletin for the first 100 years of its existence, Campbell and Fisk, methods paper, which he said, when I told him it was the most cited paper, he said, yeah, they cite it, but they don't read it. So he was a little cynical too. But anyway, so I was brought up with somebody who studied psychology and wanted accountability. You couldn't just proclaim things, you had to have, you know, good evidence for them. And then my mother was a big advocate for women's rights and immigrants' rights and various things. And she came from her mother and grandmother, my great-grandmother and great-great-grandmother were women's suffrage people. So they worked for votes for women. So I had this combination of sort of social issues and rigorous psychology in my head growing up. And so when I went to my 10th high school reunion, and people said, oh, what are you doing? I said, I'm an assistant professor. And they said, of course. Huh. I'm glad you knew, because I didn't have any idea. I didn't have a clue. What happened with me was I went to college, And as I said, I tried to major in English Lit, and that was really unsatisfying. Then I thought philosophy would be good. That's about how people make decisions about things. And then it was all logic. But, ugh, you know, it's not really how people I know think. And then I said, okay, if you major in this thing called social relations, it involves anthropology and psychology and, you know, all these different things. And I spent 4 years at Harvard avoiding Harvard. I made up classes to take. I made up a psychology of religion class. I went away for my junior year, went around the world with Gregory Bateson, and I'm a genetic psychologist, and, you know, visited all these cultures and analyzed them, and came back, and I had a terrible senior thesis. I mean, I thought it was good. It was about therapeutic tutoring little kids. But I just got torn up working with these kids. You know, they had a good day and I'd be exuberant, and they'd have a bad day and I'd be depressed. And I couldn't take it. Turned out I didn't have a very good supervisor. I mean, a good supervisor would explain to you, you have to, you know, create boundaries. And you can't serve the kid if you can't separate yourself. But I didn't know that. So halfway through senior year, I said to one of my roommates, there were a dozen people sharing a big house, more than a dozen, 15, actually oftentimes 14, because we each would cook once every 2 weeks. So the food was really great. Huh. And this was the only other psychology person in the house. And I said, David, what do I do? My senior thesis is a complete waste of time. It's terrible. I'll finish it, but I hate it. He said, you could do research. I said, I can do research. How can I do research? He said, well, volunteer to work for a professor. And I said, why do they want me? I don't know anything. He said, but you're free labor. So I said, well, who do I work with? I was pretty hopeless, right? You know, it's like I was just grilling him for advice. And he said, well, there's Freed and there's Roger and there's so-and-so and Steve and Shelley and all these other people. I said, that one sounds female. I just thought, because I had a father who was in the field, you know, it was too complicated. It wasn't even Freudian, you know, just too complicated. So I said, I'll go see the female person. So I walked into her office in January of my senior year. And I said, I want to work on your research. And she went, okay. Come back tomorrow. It was her first year as an assistant professor. She didn't have anything designed yet. But she was told, if you sit there, they will come. And so we did a study together, and it came out, from my point of view, exactly how she said it would. I thought, this is really cool. You can set up this whole scenario. People interact. It's like a stage. I liked theater. You know, you could tell a story. There was statistics, which I liked too. There was writing. And it was all about people. So I was hooked. And I worked for her as a research assistant until I, a year later, applied for graduate school. At that point, I thought, why should I leave? Because this is working so well. You know, why go through all this grief to find a different advisor? So I stayed. And as I said, I hadn't really taken classes from people. I'd avoided taking classes from people. So I finally did.
This really speaks to the importance of female role models, or just in general, role models who are like you, who might be from a somewhat underrepresented background.
It's easier to make sense of how you would do what they do. So Shelley is 5 years older than me. So I was just ready to go into graduate school. She was just done with graduate school. And I got to know her personally while I was her RA, because she and Dave Kenny and Reed Hasty were all assistant professors, and they would go out for a drink on Thursdays. But they had three, and they needed a fourth. They needed a female person, right? There were not very many female people. So I was precociously dragged along to this oldies bar where we would sit around and try to identify what oldie it was in the first few bars of the song. And I turned out to be good at it, because Reed Hasty was good at it too, but I was good at it because I grew up on the south side of Chicago and they played a lot of Motown. So, you know, I got to know these people under informal circumstances. And I thought, these are people who work hard and they play hard. I could do that. And they're interesting and smart as all get out, all three of those people. So I could imagine how to get from where I was to where they were. If I had worked with some old guy who was, you know, 40 years older than me, his life story would not have fit mine, and it would have been really hard to figure it out. So I think it's helpful to know at least, you know, some of the, I hate to say this, but to know some of the junior people, or to know the stories of the older people to the extent that they fit your circumstances. There are advantages and dis to working with younger and older mentors, but she really taught me how to be a professional.
Building on this, what is your advice for young, especially female psychologists who still worry if they belong, if their research matters, if they should even be pursuing a career in academia?
So I've been writing lately about love and work. Middle-class women do have the possibility sometimes of not having a serious career, you know, having a spouse who does the money earning. And that was the kind of thing my mother did, but it had a lot to do with World War II and the Depression and her own mother and grandmother and so on. But my own feeling about it is that most explicitly for women, there's a choice between defining yourself completely in terms of your home and your family, and defining yourself totally in terms of your work. And I was determined to hit the golden mean of balance because I felt like my mother had done one, my grandmother and great-grandmother had done all work and no responsibility for their kids. They just paid someone to look after their kids. And I wanted to sort of do both. And so I worked at it and, you know, fumbled some things and did better on others. And, you know, I have a great daughter and great stepson. And so I think with both, especially doing both at once, you have to really want to do it. And I was really determined. I knew from the get-go that I wanted to have kids, and I knew from the get-go that I wanted to be a self-sufficient professional. And I didn't want to be in a position where I couldn't afford to leave somebody if the thing was bad. Because if you don't have saleable skills, you're trapped. And I've known men like that too, but mostly it's a problem for women. So, okay, more on the front of, was it all inevitable? My first job, the department chair walked in the first day and he said, "You're at Carnegie Mellon. We like people to sign a document saying that they won't require us to bring them up for tenure in the 7 years recommended by the AAUP, American Association of University Professors." And I thought, oh, that's strange. Well, it's okay. I'm so precocious. It won't matter. And besides, it's the department chair on the first day of work, you know. So I signed the document saying it wouldn't hold them to the 7-year rule. And at 6 years, they brought me up for promotion, but not tenure, which is they sort of routinely did. And the department chair asked for my CV. He said, "We might bring you up for early tenure." And I said, "Okay." And the meeting was over and nobody called me. And nobody called me. And I went home for dinner. Nobody called me. And no messages the next morning. The next afternoon, the department chair called me into his office and was visibly upset. He said, "They hate you." He didn't say quite that many words, but he said, "What have you done, you know, to your colleagues?" And I said, "I don't know." He said, "I've gone to the university president and he's willing to break precedent and give you a terminal promotion. So we're going to promote you from assistant to associate, but you have to leave in 2 years. And I was like, "What?" You know, and you told me, I mean, I didn't say it that way, but I was like thinking, like, what's going on? Well, I had not been properly respectful of my senior colleagues. And, you know, looking back on it, it's hard for me to imagine, but I guess I was snarky or something, rude, disrespectful. Anyway, I didn't build any allies. when you go into a promotion proceeding, somebody has to argue for you. And if nobody feels responsible for your career, if you haven't asked their advice and, you know, respected them, why should they want you to be around? So I had friends in the field, but I didn't have local advocates who were old, just a little older than me. And in fact, I've been obnoxious, I guess, and we had some reasons for tension. And so it was good I left, because it would have been miserable to stay. But I had to grapple with, was I going to stay in the field? You know, and then I said, well, I don't want to do anything else. I don't want to be a lawyer. So I got back on the horse. I made myself go to conferences. People had heard. It wasn't technically a tenure decision, but it was. But I tried to pretend it wasn't. I said, well, I got promoted to associate without tenure. And then I went to UMass Amherst, where there were all these wonderful, intellectual, smart people who had a life besides their work. And they had the work-life balance thing down. And they're really interesting minds, too, really smart and theoretically particularly smart. So you'd present an idea, and there's one person who would say, oh, you think that A leads to B, but I think B leads to A. You know, have you considered the alternative form of cause? Or the other person who would say, this relates to my theory, which eats your theory for lunch, and say, no, it doesn't. You know, anyway, so it was always very interesting. And I had my most creative 14 years at UMass, just because people were so invested in the ideas and not trying to kill each other off. Anyway, so, you know, I tell people now the story to say, look, it turned out okay. But there was, you know, it was really a rough spot. And moreover, you know, I didn't get the Princeton job right away. I interviewed at Princeton when I came out of graduate school. I didn't get the job. But I did get it later when I didn't want it. I wasn't looking. But, you know, I said, oh, Princeton, But it was definitely a consideration. So you have to want to do it, I think, is the bottom line. You know, if you can imagine doing anything else, then don't go into psychology, because you have to get rejected a lot. I've been rejected by some of the best universities in the country. And you just say, no, my ideas are worth pursuing. And maybe they're going to make the world a better place.
Thank you for sharing that. I think it would be a good way slowly to come to an end of our conversation with this one more question. Do you think incentives in academia are changing, especially for people who do not fit the standard old, white, straight men narrative who might have always felt like they belong in academia?
I'm not sure incentives are changing. Well, except for social media. I'm not sure what would have been the old time equivalent of maybe somebody who told good stories over a drink. I mean, people would find you entertaining, but unless you did something else in addition, it wasn't going to go anywhere. I mean, I think, to be honest, my own model, what I tell my students, is the bottom line is you have to publish research articles a lot. And they have to go together, be programmatic. And you have to like doing it, because, you know, you get rejected more often than not, right? So it's perseverance furthers. It really is. It's a marathon. You just have to keep going. But if you're excited about your ideas, you know, keeping going is what you want to do anyway. And I do think that we can do some good in the world as social psychologists. So I think the knowledge that we have is special, and we deal with the whole person in context. And that can change people's lives. It can change the society's view of things. So, yeah, you couldn't get me to do anything else. I feel lucky to be paid to do what I love to do. But if you think of anything else you could do, then do that.
What a beautiful way to end. Thank you so much for this conversation and for taking the time.
Sure, sure. Well, your questions are astute, and your excitement is contagious. It's helpful.
Thank you so much for listening. We would love to hear what you think of this episode, or if you have any other suggestions for future guests or topics for the podcast. You can reach us at stanfordpsychpodcast@gmail.com. You can also connect with us on Twitter at stanfordpsypod. Finally, if you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere so more people can find us. Thank you so much.